From Caspary Auditorium at the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, CBS Radio presents The Great Challenge. This is the fifth of seven special programs that will bring world leaders together to consider urgent problems that face the nation in a rapidly changing world. Today, the CBS News Symposium will consider the subject, Government and the Democratic Process. And now here is the moderator of The Great Challenge, CBS News correspondent Howard K. Smith.
This is the fifth program in this series in which we seek to stimulate thinking about the challenge to the United States in the second half of the 20th century. Today, we turn to the characteristic feature of the American and the Western way of life, government and democratic processes. One of our guests of today has written that we are governed by an 18th century constitution composed of 17th century ideas. We want to know, can that legal basis for government cope with the hugely growing and swiftly changing 20th century? Can free processes created for a different age compete in a world like this one and against competitors like ours? I would like now to introduce our guests. Next to me here on the platform, Alan Nevins, DeWitt Clinton Professor of American History at Columbia University, a Pulitzer Prize winner for biography. Arthur Kroc, the distinguished Washington columnist for the New York Times, twice winner of Pulitzer Prize citations. Arthur Schlesinger, professor of history at Harvard, and again a Pulitzer Prize winner. Ernest K. Lindley, director of the Washington Bureau of Newsweek magazine, twice winner of the Overseas Press Award for news interpretation. Dr. Elmer E. Schottschneider, professor of government at Wesleyan University, once president of the American Political Science Association, and Emmett J. Hughes, chief of foreign correspondence for Time Incorporated. Well, I would like to begin, gentlemen, by asking you the most general possible question in this field. How would you state the challenge that we face in this field of government and democratic processes? Mr. Nevins.
We must discriminate between the machinery of democracy, which is important, and between the purpose of democracy, which is far more important. The machinery of democracy embraces majority rule, universal suffrage, equal rights, and other entities. But the great question is, for what is the machinery to be used? The vitalizing purpose of democracy is to elevate the individual and at the same time to improve the general social lot. Now it seems to me that the great challenge to democracy is this. Can democracy anticipate the problems to come in performing these purposes, and can it lay plans to meet them?
Mr. Kroc.
The challenge, it seems to me, is not, as Professor Nevins says, not in the machinery, but is very much in the machinists and in the consumers of the product of government. There's a great deal of challenge there because, in my opinion, the machinists at the moment are neglecting two things, principally. One, the fact that we have no time. We used to have time for the major decisions. We have them no more. The second is that the impulse to crowd out the rights of minorities and the deliberative process that is required to establish those rights is being very much attacked by pressure groups which have grown to enormous proportions of power in this country through the operations of party politics and the ambitions of individual politicians.
Mr. Schlesinger.
I think what may destroy our society is our inability to bring to focus the qualities of strength which exist in our nation and in our tradition. And this seems to me the problem of leadership, and I would think the great challenge which we now confront is to do something to revive in our society a conception of creative leadership in all fields, not just in politics, but in education and in many other areas of our national life.
Mr. Lindley?
It seems to me that we're in the presence of three events occurring simultaneously, three developments, each of an epochal nature. One is the rise of the Soviet Union as a great power under the leadership of men hostile to our concept, who believe that their way will triumph inevitably and who lose no opportunity to pursue energetically, skillfully, ruthlessly the purpose of achieving the triumph of their way of life. The second is the technological and scientific advance, inward into the atom and outward into space. The third is the emergence of the peoples of Asia and Africa as self-governing peoples, bringing to an end an epoch that began with the age of exploration. Our most serious problems, it seems to me, come from the interaction of those epochal advance. And it seems to me there are two central questions arising out of that with respect to our governmental apparatus and our political practices. One is whether we can react quickly enough and with enough power or in the right way to cope with these challenges to our survival. And the other is whether we have the stamina and the means to project and carry forward our long-range plan. Now, as to the first, whether we can react quickly, our experience in this century, since we've lost our isolation, has indicated that our institutions are capable of handling acute and obvious dangers from abroad. And I believe that they can be adjusted to meet the necessity for even quicker action in the future. The other question, the longer range one, I think is less one of our institutions than of the stamina, resolution, and understanding of the American people.
Dr. Schatzschneider?
Seems to me that perhaps the greatest question immediately before the American people is the question of their morale. Because it seems to me our political institutions are, to a very great extent, an embodiment of the faith of the American people. Almost anything is possible in the American political system, it seems to me, as long as the American people don't lose their nerve, don't become confused, and continue to stand by the values that underlie the system.
Mr. Hughes.
We all tend, I think, especially in days of self-examination, to use words like stamina, leadership, fervor, dedication, without very precisely defining what are the ends to which we are trying to be dedicated. Take a couple of concrete examples. We speak of education with reverence. We know we have problems of building schools, raising the salaries of teachers. Let us assume these issues are met. But what is the final purpose of this education? Is it or is it not the training of individuals to be sensitive to the values by which they are going to live and by which our society is going to live? And if so, what are these values? The issue of world conflict. We spend a wealth of time, energy, and money, presumably in containing the aggressive threat of Soviet communism. But what is the end of this effort? We surely do not expect someday Soviet communism to throw down its arms and fall on its knees and worship at the shrine of Western civilization and ask forgiveness for its international sins. What then is the end we are seeking? In short, what is the democratic process dedicated to achieve? Until we answer that question, it's a little difficult to determine whether it's working well.
Well, you've posed a great number of questions. I would like to pose one quickly before we go to a general question myself. I would like to ask Dr. Schatzschneider this question. It has been proved aeronautically that the bumblebee cannot fly, yet it flies. And European observers of our Constitution say it cannot work, but it works. Why does it work?
I suppose this system works because the American people work it. I think we're so accustomed to the idea that people have a sense of responsibility for the success of the regime that we take it for granted. But this is a great American phenomenon. And they make a lot of things work a lot better than they might otherwise, and this applies all along the line.
In Mr. Kroc's newspaper, Barbara Ward some time ago mentioned the fact that the Russians can plan their foreign aid 10, 12, 20 years ahead. We can't. We have to plan foreign aid from year to year because we persuade Congress from year to year. Can someone suggest an answer to that question after you're putting all those questions? Mr. Schlesinger.
Well, I would think, of course, it can do it if it is provided with the kind of leadership that will explain effectively what is at stake and will mobilize the support for objectives. Some leaders, conceiving politics as essentially an educational process, regard it as their responsibility to keep the voters informed of the nature of problems and to give them information, make available to them information upon which they can base responsible decision. Another type of leader prefers to smooth over, minimize problems, and I think that kind of leadership inevitably produces boredom, and it also makes it very difficult for a democracy to develop that kind of sustained commitment of which Barbara Ward was speaking.
Mr. Nevins?
Now, leadership is vital because public opinion counts for nothing until it is organized and crystallized, and it cannot be organized and crystallized except by leadership. But I would object to Mr. Schlesinger's definition or implied definition of leadership. He seems to think that it's an individual matter. If we look at the history of the United States, Mr. Schlesinger, I think you will agree with me that leadership has passed through various phases in America. We had at first a very aristocratic kind of leadership embodied in Washington and John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. Then, after the abolition of the legislative caucus in 1824, we had a leadership of party managers. And that lasted until about 1860, when we really began to have a different kind of leadership. And in that leadership, I think a very great role was played not by individuals, not by party managers, but by the newspaper press, which was our first great phenomenon in the field of mass media. The newspaper press exercised a very large degree of leadership. And I would like to know from Mr. Kroc why it is that the newspaper press today offers so little leadership to the American democracy.
Mr. Kroc?
Does it offer so little? I think that it offers a great deal, eliminating anything it might have any connection with me. I think that the Charleston News and Courier certainly is a leader in its field of opinion, and very strongly indeed. The Baltimore Sun leads very well in that area. The Chicago Tribune, whatever you may think of it, is indeed a leader of thought in the whole Middle West and tremendously powerful and important. So I can't concede your premise, but sitting between these two professors of history is a pretty dangerous position. I was amazed at both, because I don't know what Mr. Schlesinger means about leadership. It seems to me that Eisenhower is leading now in threatening vetoes. If that isn't leadership, I don't know what it could be. Now, he's been at many times, I think, open to criticism that he didn't. But when he threatens a veto, he's following through, and I think he's leading.
You said the Soviet Union, quoting Barbara Ward, could plan 10 years ahead. We do have the techniques of projecting these things into the future. Of course, you can never be sure that another Congress will or won't appropriate the money. But neither can the Soviet Union be absolutely sure that a program laid down now will be carried out 10 years. Khrushchev may go out, Suslov or somebody else may come. There may be changing circumstances. But we have demonstrated in this post-war period with the Marshall Plan, when we could project something ahead for 4 or 5 years, and while it was subject to annual appropriations, it was pretty well understood we were going to carry forward with it. And of course we do that through, in various other ways, through our treaty commitments, NATO and CETO and other, which stretch far into the future.
I must quote Barbara Ward once more. She sat in this chair recently, that's why I quote her so often. She maintained that we have done these things in the past, but in the past few years, she said, American leadership has been losing momentum. Do you agree with that? Does anyone have any points of view on that? Mr. Schlesinger.
Well, yes, I would like to just advert briefly to the question of leadership. I think that leadership, obviously, as Mr. Kroc suggests, means a good deal more than a series of one-shot interventions. I think the kind of leadership I have in mind, if I may get away from domestic examples, which may appear to have an air of which may arouse partisan emotions, is the kind of leadership that Winston Churchill supplied in England, and that's quite a different kind of leadership in its sense of the role of the nature of the historical crisis and its capacity for day-to-day support, both with the people and with the Parliament. It's quite a different kind of leadership from anything we've had in this country since January 1953.
Mr. Hughes?
Sir Winston Churchill, indeed, an admirable figure, a man with a great capacity for arousing his people behind him. And yet, immediately after the war, he was promptly voted out of office. I doubt if that was an electoral verdict that Mr. Schlesinger would deplore. The issues are important, the substantive issues, not whether we like virtues. We all do.
Well, Ellen Nevins?
As Barbara Ward is not here, I can say that I'm astonished at the position she took. Anyone with the slightest acquaintance with history should know that a broadly based democracy has far more stability and endurance than any autocracy or dictatorship. Would anyone say that the autocracies of Hungary and Poland have shown exemplary stability and unity in recent years? On the contrary. The American democracy, however, has never lacked unity in any great critical moment. It has never lacked staying power. And it, one advantage of the American system is that while in the ordinary course of events, our government runs along with a full consultation of the will of the majority, in any extreme crisis, we can cast aside, to a great extent, the ordinary trammels of the Constitution and concentrate power in the executive sufficiently to meet that crisis. That has been proved in every really great war that the United States has fought.
Well, let me turn your attention for a moment to a structural problem in American democracy, one that our European allies are frequently exasperated at. They say that our lower house of Congress is constantly on the eve of elections and therefore cannot make objective judgments on issues. Tell me, do you find that this structural problem is a serious one in the way of decision-making in a democracy? Mr. Kroc?
I think it's definitely serious. You can always see the effects of it. I think that it's since the president is given a legislative role in veto, it seems to me that that disposes of any concern about it, and I'd like to see the House of Representatives elected with the president and for 4 years, and I think you'd find a great, great improvement in the executive legislative process. But there's one thing I don't think has been mentioned here, at least very tenderly, and I'm not tender on the subject at all. The issue between the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and the unusual, dangerous, perilous situation we find ourselves in is being resolved on a basis as if this were the 18th century, there were sailing ships crossing the ocean. The only way the court can possibly supervised by popular opinion or even by public necessity is self-restraint and common sense. And in that particular, I think it's shown neither. And yet it's been perfectly able to distinguish between a senior and a junior provision in the Constitution by saying one, as Holmes in his Clear and Present Danger, one, for the purposes of the time and the emergency, must supervene the other. That is not doing enough.
Gentlemen, I want to change the subject now before we go into that. Conditions and institutions are changing very greatly in the United States these days, and I would like to ask you what you think will be the effect of some of these changes. For example, World War II and now the Cold War have caused us to maintain a very large military establishment. Do you consider that that can become a serious menace to American diplomacy? I ask that question because it's highly topical, since we're considering reorganizing that Defense Department now to centralize command very strongly. Has anyone any views on that? Dr. Schatzschneider.
I don't think the locus of power is in the same places anymore. And I suspect that the presidential nominating process is undergoing changes. These things work informally under the influence of the changing values of the competitors for power in the system. The primacy of foreign policy, I think, is having an enormous effect on the system.
Do you think that this growth of the military has any menace to our democratic institution? Mr. Lindley?
No, I do not. The function of the military today is to prevent war, and they understand that, to prevent the loss of our, or impairment of our national interests without resort to war. I see no rise of a military clique as such. In fact, it seems to me that despite all we've criticized sometimes, some of us, about the professional officers speaking up, that we're not in danger of any military dictatorship. We've elected one of our distinguished military men to the presidency, and he certainly has shown no inclination toward dictatorship. Quite the opposite.
I would like to ask you what you think the effect will be of another development of our time. Since the 30s, the government has penetrated what we call a free or private economy very strongly indeed. It controls, it supports, and in some places it owns parts of the economy. Do you consider that this is a menace to our freedoms? Mr. Schlesinger.
I do not. I think that far from being a menace to our freedom, great foundations upon which our freedom exists. There have been a number of threats to freedom in this century. One of the worst threats, which we've forgotten about, though we're beginning to think about it again, is the threat of mass unemployment. I think that the kind of mixture of government and private enterprise, which we have in our current economy, the so-called mixed economy, provides, among other things, a whole arsenal of weapons with which to combat mass unemployment. If we were to renounce those weapons through trying to minimize or dismantle this apparatus of government control, I can think of no quicker way than to assure our own vulnerability in almost every respect.
Mr. Kroc?
I think that private industry and private enterprise is so far better able to maintain employment than the government on any sound economic basis that it would be far more desirable to have less and less government in business for that reason.
Well, that leads me to another question. Does anyone feel that the tendency towards bigness in our institutions is a menace to democratic institutions? Big industry, big labor, and in fact, big government. Any answers on that? Dr. Schatzner.
I think government has to be big in a time when you have so much big industry. It has to cope with this sort of thing. I think it could show that changes in the organization of the economy always reflect themselves in the organization of government. And I think for a reason of maintaining some kind of equilibrium within the system, it takes a big government to cope with the kinds of problems we have.
Well, how about the bigness of the other institution, Mr. Schlesinger?
I think what we have to do is, while accepting the technical advantages that bigness produces, and while understanding that big business produced big labor and big labor, the combination produced big government, and they're all here to stay, that somehow we must find chinks and fissures in this system where the critical and irreverent and satirical and challenging and inquisitive mind can flourish.
Mr. Nevins?
May I suggest that the analysis here might be carried just a bit further? Why is it that big labor, big business, big finance, the farm blocks place a larger part in our politics? I think it is largely because our two great political parties are composite parties, which definitely exclude economic blocks or pressures. The Republican and Democratic parties both embrace labor. They both embrace farmers. They both embrace business and finance. The only way in which these separate specialized entities can make their influence felt, and it ought to be felt, is as pressure groups in Washington. It would be a great mistake if parties aligned themselves on economic grounds or religious grounds or sectional grounds or any other grounds. They must try to cover over, roof over as many elements in the population as possible. That leaves the way open for these special groups, which ought to be heard, to make themselves heard through lobbies in Washington.
Now, I've been asking you a lot of negative questions. I'd like to ask you a positive one. Not a menace, but are we getting the most out of our people? In the past 10 days, two different articulate groups have suggested that we have think groups, bodies of representing all marches of American life to advise the government. Mr. Baruch suggested this. The Rockefeller Brothers report suggested this. Do you believe that this is a proposal with any merit? Mr. Schlesinger.
I doubt very much whether it has any merit, and it seems to me the nature of the proposal is an expression of exactly what is wrong with our society. And that is that they think that everything can be solved by appointing a new committee or by getting a new collection of wise men. And that if you get enough people around the table, they'll come up with some sagacious and lasting solution. But it is not that easy. And merely the quantitative addition of one person on top of another does not increase the amount of effective wisdom in the room. I think what we need is much more solitary thinking and much less group thinking. Now, I think that when we understand that the problems we face aren't going to be papered over by formulas produced from a committee, but are going to be worked out by people who brood by themselves in a room and try to get to the roots of the question, then we'll be much better off. I think that kind of solution is exactly the way we've kidded ourselves too long, and we're likely to kid ourselves into disaster if we continue it.
Any other remarks on that? Mr. Hughes.
I rejoice, Mr. Smith, in the rather rare experience of agreeing completely with Mr. Schlesinger. I think the one area perhaps where I would extend his remarks is that if we converted the phrase democratic process into the phrase democratic debate, that our most serious domestic dilemma is that we aren't debating the issues we should be debating, but we are talking in terms of slogans, catchwords, exhortations, incantations. Concrete example, surely in the area of foreign policy, in world policy, survival, one of the major issues to be considered is, do we or do we not favor bilateral discussions between the United States and the Soviet Union? This, where everyone stands on the issue, is an important one, and this, you can be sure, is an issue not being discussed or debated today.
Well, Mr. Hughes, that's a very good point, and it's an extremely good point to end on, because the purpose of this program is just that. Now I have just about 2 minutes to try to summarize what you've been saying. I'm impressed by the highly optimistic view that all of you take on the workings, the present, and the future of democratic institutions. I asked you if our 18th century constitution with its 17th century ideas works in the 20th century, and everyone, I think, said it does work and will go on working well because people make it do so. I inquired if democracy is capable of making the right decisions fast enough. Yes, said Mr. Schlesinger, if issues are made exciting enough, but that condition, he believes, does not prevail at present. Mr. Lindley and Mr. Kroc disagreed. The problem, almost everyone agreed, was not the machinery of government. It was, as Mr. Kroc said, the machinists. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think I could add to this argument that I am told authoritatively that 4,000 to 6,000 refugees cross one side or other of the Iron Curtain each week to come to our side to live, while none cross and go the other way except as tourists. I think that is sufficient indication that our system is doing well.
You have been listening to The Great Challenge, the fifth of 7 special symposiums dealing with critical issues facing the American people. Today's program considered government and the democratic process. 3 weeks from today, on May 22nd at this same time, The Great Challenge will present a discussion of the question, what makes an effective foreign policy? Joining our symposium on May 22nd will be Lester Pearson, winner of the 1957 Nobel Peace Prize and former Canadian Minister of State for External Affairs, Anthony Nutting, former British Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Eric Johnston, president of the Motion Picture Association of America and former presidential advisor on the Near East, Dean Rusk, president of the Rockefeller Foundation, Paul Nitzer, former director of the policy planning staff of the U.S. State Department, and Robert Bowie, director of the Center for International Affairs at Harvard. Howard K. Smith of CBS News will again be moderator. That's Thursday, May 22nd. The Great Challenge is produced by James F. Fleming. Associate producer, Richard Simonovsky. This was a presentation of CBS News. America listens most to the CBS Radio Network.